This to in-rate detention of Jaeger.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'll go ahead and reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, please. Marla Zink of the Washington Appellate Project here on behalf of Gregory Jaeger. This is a civil commitment trial where we raise serious errors in the briefing, and I'm going to try and focus here on the taint and voir dire, the exclusion of evidence from the community placement program, and touch briefly on prosecutorial misconduct. But I also want to set the stage for what was at stake here in this trial and what the evidence was, and that's critically important in terms of evaluating the harm of all these errors, either singularly or in the cumulative. Here we have Gregory Jaeger, who at age 16, at his first birthday party, in the course of 1 hour or probably less, approached two young boys in a restroom.
We are aware of the facts.
Okay. I'm happy to move on to the issues then. In terms of the tainted jury pool, there were three jurors who, during voir dire, discussed, based on professional opinions, that the heart of this case, which was that people like Mr. Jaeger, if released, would reoffend.
Okay, so the motion for mistrial related to Juror 61 and Juror 61 only. The other two jurors, there was no motion. Those responses were in connection with or related to what the attorneys were asking, particularly, I think, defense counsel or counsel for Mr. Jaeger. So I don't know if you want to address why we should look at jurors 2 and 117, or if you're just going to focus on juror 61, because that was the juror that was subject to the motion for mistrial that you addressed in your brief.
No, I believe that the court should look at all three, because this is a manifest constitutional error that goes to Mr. Jaeger's right to a constitutional, to an impartial jury, and due process right, and also state constitutional right. But I would also say that the court understood that trial counsel had continuing objections. So when
no,
there was ruling,
the continuing objection came much later in trial, and it had nothing to do with what happened in voir dire.
Well, the court's statement came later in trial, but his statement was all-encompassing. But even
it
without
wasn't
that,
all-encompassing to be retroactive to voir dire.
Well, I would disagree with that, but if the court wants to read it that way, then we still have a manifest constitutional error here. And even if the court doesn't look at the manifest constitutional error, Juror 61 alone rises to the level of Mock versus Stewart, where, again, one individual during voir dire broadcast to the jury their experienced position on the heart of the case. And here we have a career police officer who said he had investigated hundreds of sexual abuse cases, and he presumes in his professional experience that they are more likely than not to reoffend, and he presumes that he needs to watch out for these guys. So you can imagine the effect that has on a jury when one of their own, a peer, provides anecdotes.
Well, that isn't exactly what he said. He did not say more likely to reoffend until he was questioned individually right before he was excused. So that is not what he said when he was in the jury veneer.
But what was discussed when he was individually questioned was what the implication of what he said in the voir dire was. And everyone understood, the state, the defense counsel, and the court and this witness understood that that was what he meant. And the jury had the same presumption. And then that's repeated by juror 2, who says that a deputy sheriff friend of his said that if there's something sexual, there's no cure for it. So when juveniles steal cars, we can presume that they're going to grow out of that. But when juveniles commit sex offenses, we presume that they're going to commit again. And this was broadcast to the juror. And then in addition to that, we have juror 117, who worked in an institution, had a patient who was released. This is what the juror relates to the rest of the panel, and says that released sex abuser was found within a week of release with a young boy in the car with him ready to recommit. So this is the non-evidentiary portion of the trial, where the jury is already tainted about what's to come. These were all said in statements in front of the whole jury. And we believe that rises beyond the level of Mock versus Stewart, where the Ninth Circuit stopped short of calling it structural error, but clearly was considering it easily could be. This goes to the heart of the matter, which is whether Mr. Jaeger was more likely than not to reoffend if he was released.
Maybe you should move to the community protection program.
Sure. The reason that the evidence should have come in about the community placement program was that Mr. Jaeger was eligible for the program. He would have applied if he had been released. and it would have been an incentive for him to comply with the rest of the release plan. And that is in post. The fact that there's a recent overt act that would cause someone to not want to reoffend if released, that makes this case analogous. So in other words, there is an additional factor in the release plan that the jury didn't get to hear about that would provide Mr. Yeager with a heavy incentive not to reoffend because he was applying for this community placement program.
Well, he had not applied. But
he had not applied.
He planned to apply.
Correct. And our argument here is that the evidence that the court should have allowed in was that if released, the condition that would exist would be that he would apply to the community placement program. That could be subject to cross-examination that he's not admitted yet, that there is no guarantee that he would be admitted, but it would also, the evidence that should have come in, would be that he would be incentivized to comply with the rest of the release plan because the community placement program, in looking at his application, would consider whether his ability to live in the community and to follow the release plan. So for those reasons, we believe that evidence should have been admitted. And again, standing alone or in the cumulative requires a new trial here.
So you're arguing it was an abuse of discretion?
That's correct. And in terms of prosecutorial misconduct, I just want to note that what the prosecutor was arguing was certainly inflammatory, but also in terms of the comment on defense evidence and defense's case, it was burden shifting because what the state said here, what the experienced prosecutor said in rebuttal, was that that Mr. Yeager had an abject complete refusal to face head-on in any substantive way the enormous volume of evidence that the state presented in this case. And this court well knows that Mr. Yeager had no obligation to do that. Now, the prosecutor could have attacked the evidence that Mr. Yeager did present, but in terms of talking about responding to the state's case, Mr. Yeager had no obligation to do that. And to tell the jury otherwise is burden shifting here. And I'll go ahead and save the remainder for rebuttal. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. Andrea Vitalich from the King County Prosecutor's Office on behalf of the respondent, State of Washington. We'd ask the court to affirm Mr. Yeager's civil commitment in this case. First, I'll touch on what counsel is characterizing as a tainted jury pool issue. Juror 61, as a police officer, made some negative remarks about sex offenders based on his experience, that they band together and I need to watch out for these guys. And he also expressed that he was jaded after being a police officer for many years. And none of those remarks would have been a surprise, I think, to anyone in the veneer. And the remarks by the other two jurors were not preserved. I would also note that by the end of this particular trial, given the evidence that was presented and given the length of time that the trial took place, the likelihood that anyone had any memory of what was said in voir dire is vanishingly small. So therefore, even if the court reaches the issue with respect to all three of the jurors, it's plainly harmless.
Well, there's a dispute about whether the arguments as to jurors 2 and 17 is preserved. What's your response to that?
Well, as I set forth in my brief, our position is that that is not preserved. The remarks in question were made in response to defense counsel's questioning. There was no objection or motion for mistrial outside the presence of the jurors or otherwise. And as Your Honor noted, the continuing objection discussion took place much later in the trial and was based on some evidentiary rulings that counsel was objecting to, not anything that happened during voir dire. So it would be the state's position that Mr. Yeager would have to show a manifest error affecting a constitutional right in order to raise anything with respect to those jurors. And once again, that leads back into my remarks about the chances of anyone recalling what was said during voir dire in this particular case.
So why isn't it a manifest error affecting constitutional right? Because it's not manifest or because it's not error?
I would say both. In these cases are obviously quite a bit different from a lot of other cases with respect to the topics that are brought up during voir dire. Obviously, voir dire in this case took place over a period of several days, as is typical in these cases. And in these cases in particular, a lot of attention is paid to people's notions, assumptions, and indeed in this case, some at least passing experience with sex offenders and their likelihood to reoffend. In the context of this particular case, there's been no showing that anything that any juror has had to say during voir dire in response to any of the questioning or otherwise would have affected the sitting juror's ability to follow the instructions as given by the trial court, which I think would be necessary here.
So the case that is being relied on by Mr. Yeager is the Mock versus Stewart case. Why is this not like that case with Juror 61's comments?
Well, first of all, that was a criminal case, so it would have been looked at specifically under the cases or under the presumption of innocence, which does not apply here. Here we have a straight due process analysis because the cases hold that the expressly conferred constitutional trial rights do not apply in civil cases. I'm not saying there isn't a due process right to a fair trial. There certainly is. But I'm just saying that those that the Mock versus Stewart is in a different context of cases. In addition, I took a look at the citing references for Mock versus Stewart, and I think it's fair to say that that case is an outlier because I found far more cases distinguishing it or refusing to follow it on state law grounds in some cases than I found citing it for the proposition for which it is decided.
So let's move to the exclusion of evidence related to the community protection program?
Yes, Your Honor. First, it's important to note that what Mr. Yeager is arguing on appeal is different from what he argued to the trial court. What he argued to the trial court is that he should be allowed to present evidence of the community protection program, or CPP, as evidence of a program that he was going to be participating in, not that he was simply going to be applying for that program. And I think counsel essentially agrees with that in the reply brief, noting that the argument on appeal is it's characterized as being narrower as what was argued to the trial court, but that means it was different from what was argued to the trial court. If Mr.
Was the briefing such that it encompassed, did participating encompass applying for? I know this is a bit esoteric.
Well, yes, if one wants to draw a Venn diagram between those two arguments, the application for the program would necessarily be encompassed in the eventual participation in the program. But I don't think it's incumbent on the trial court to make an evidentiary ruling based on a motion that wasn't actually made. The motion that was made in this case was to admit evidence of the community protection program as a program that Mr. Yeager was going to be participating in, not one that he was merely going to be applying for. If defense counsel wanted to offer the evidence of the mere application as a fallback position, that certainly is a possibility that could have happened, but I don't think it's incumbent on the trial court to say, well, I'm not going to admit the program in its entirety, but sua sponte, I'll let you talk about applying for it.
So there was a lot of briefings. So is the defense request clearly stated someplace in the CPs?
I cited in my brief, I'd have to go back and look for the specific CPs, but I know one quote that one quotation I included in my brief from defense counsel's briefing was that the CPP was Mr. Yeager's long-term release plan.
All right, so we'll just look at that.
It's the state's position with respect to the trial court's ruling on the CPP that we never get to the question of the constitutionality of the one phrase of the statute that's specific to the CPP, because as the trial court ruled here, Mr. Yeager presented insufficient evidence that the CPP was an option that, quote unquote, would exist for him in the community if he were to be released from being detained at the SCC in this proceeding.
So in other words, it was speculative at that point.
That's correct. And I would note the testimony of Ms. Gianetto Bear, who was the coordinator of the program, who was essentially the person who would be in charge of screening an application and being involved in the decision-making process, who agreed with the prosecutor that at this point, at the point of trial, Mr. Yeager's acceptance in the program was essentially hypothetical. The trial court, once that evidence in the record supports the trial court's finding in that respect, that this was not an option that would exist for Mr. Yeager in the community, and that factual finding in turn supports the trial court's legal ruling in that respect, that this was not an option that would exist. I would just note,
does the CPP actually have committed sexual predators?
No. The record, as the record in this case reflects, no one who is facing an SVP petition or committed as an SVP can use this program. Also, the testimony before the trial court in the pretrial hearing established that not only had no committed sexually violent predators ever been accepted into this program, but no one who had ever been detained at the Special Commitment Center on a pending petition for an SVP trial had been accepted into this program.
I mean, the program isn't a... It's a developmental disabilities
That is correct.
Program. It's not specifically related to the whole sexual predator system.
No, it's a program that's specifically designed for offenders with developmental disabilities. And here, although
It was the theory that he was autistic. Was that what was going to get him in?
Well, and I think even the state's expert agreed that there were some developmental issues with Mr. Yeager. But the problem here is that a program like the CPP isn't designed for offenders who are also mentally ill as defined by the sexually violent predator statute. And it's clear that the legislative intent is to address the mental abnormalities and personality disorders that make sexually violent predators more likely than not to reoffend if in the community, rather than placing them in a program where you have what I would imagine a number of vulnerable individuals who have developmental disabilities. That would be a fairly dangerous situation for others in the CPP, potentially.
So in 19 seconds, why wasn't the burden-shifting argument flagrant and ill-intentioned?
Well, I would disagree that it's a burden-shifting argument. I would agree that if Mr. Yeager had presented no evidence, that would have been a burden-shifting argument. But like in a criminal case, even though a sexually violent predator respondent doesn't have a burden of proof in these cases, once he chooses to present evidence, it's entirely appropriate for the prosecutor to attack the weaknesses in that evidence that has been presented. So therefore, there has been no burden shifting. Thank you.
To be clear, the community placement program was also discussed at the pretrial motions, and so I would urge the court to look also at the what I refer to as the motions volume 3. I think at 366 through 79 at least, but there were several witnesses who testified pretrial in terms of whether this evidence could be admitted. The trial court regularly does distinguish among different bases and different evidence that a defendant or the state can present upon an argument, and this court has no requirement that we make the identical argument that was made below. We can certainly narrow an argument, and this court also regularly decides an issue on narrower grounds. I don't think this court would want to encourage a rule where we have to make the same broad argument whether we believe in it or not, but can make a narrower subset of an argument on appeal that was clearly before the trial court. And that's the position that we have here. And just to be clear in response to Your Honor's question before, we do believe it was an abuse of discretion not to admit the CPP evidence. If the court disagrees with that, though, it needs to address the constitutional challenges made in the briefing. Returning to the voir dire issue, Mock makes clear that it relies on due process. So just because it's a criminal trial doesn't mean that there weren't due process rights involved that also are implicated here. That's the due process right to an impartial jury that's not tainted by this extrajudicial evidence that clearly would have a persuasive effect on the heart of the trial, which again is whether Mr. Yeager is more likely than not to reoffend if released.
Going back to what you just said about the community protection program, so you said if we decided it was an abuse of discretion, then we'd stop. But if we decided it wasn't, we'd have to reach the constitutional issue?
Right. If it was not an abuse of
But in Mulkins, this court, concluded there was no standing.
That's right. But Mulkins was in a different position. Mulkins wasn't seeking to admit evidence of conditions that would exist upon release, whereas the evidence that we're trying to admit here is an application to the Community Protection Program.
But the premise of your argument is that is a program that would exist.
The right for him to apply to the program would exist as soon as he was released from the SEC if he was found not committable by this jury.
Well, wouldn't that be true of most anyone in his position?
Yes, anyone who was eligible for the community placement program.
So why is he eligible? Disabled.
Because he had a developmental disability and had been sentenced for a criminal act where the CPP program works to rehabilitate and treat people in that position.
How do you address Ms. Baer's testimony?
In what regard, Your Honor?
Well, that she says that it's just hypothetical.
Whether he would be admitted was hypothetical. The fact that he could apply was certainly not hypothetical, and this could all be fair subject for cross-examination. But what the state is trying to argue here is that because he wouldn't be accepted into the CPP program if he had been committed, he shouldn't be able to tell the jury that he could apply. And where that application would exist upon release and would also incentivize him to comply with his comprehensive release plan, supported by his parents, who, by the way, are here today, I forgot to mention, was all evidence that the jury should have been able to consider. Thank you, Your Honors. We ask that you reverse.
Thank you, Counsel. That concludes our consideration of this matter.